So good afternoon for some and good morning for others. Thank you for joining us. My name is Markia Thomas, and I will be introducing this webinar and our guest. This year's catastrophic Western wildfires have made headlines across the country, with rains having returned to much of the region. We invited four experts. We're still waiting on one to join us, but hopefully he'll pop in soon to talk about the intersection of fire and water, from drinking water safety to stream health and flood risk. We will also dig into the steps water and forest managers can take to prepare for future fires. Now I will introduce our panelists. If you could introduce yourself, tell us your first and last name, your title, and a little bit about what you do, that would be great. Let's start with Kevin.
Good morning, afternoon, folks. I'm Kevin Bladen. I'm an associate professor in the College of Forestry in the Forest Engineering Resources and Management Department at Oregon State University. I'm a forest hydrologist, have been studying wildfire effects on source water quantity, quality, and aquatic ecosystem health, as well as linkages to downstream drinking water supply and challenges for drinking water treatment for the last about 15 years in the Rocky Mountains, state of Washington, California, and Oregon.
Thank you. I see Darren has hopped on to join us. Can you go next, please?
Sure. Sorry to be late. I got back-to-back meetings. We almost need like the professors have of 10-minute grace. I'm Darren Polhamis. I'm Deputy Director for the Division of Drinking Water. We're the regulatory entity for the Safe Drinking Water Act in California. I'm just over the top of all those regulations here at the State Water Resources Control Board. We're within our Cal EPA here as well in California.
Thank you. Next, Nina, I will allow for you to introduce yourself.
Thanks. My name is Nina Oakley. I'm a research scientist in meteorology and climatology with the Center for Western Weather and Water Extremes at Scripps Institution of Oceanography at University of California, San Diego. Long, long title there. I study extreme rainfall events, what causes them and how to forecast them, as well as their impacts on the landscape and threats to life and property, including flooding and landslides.
And finally, Christina.
My name is Christina Burry. I'm a watershed scientist for Denver Water. I work to improve and protect 2.5 million acres of watershed, which is considered part of Denver Water's collection system. We serve 1.5 million customers, and my primary duty is to manage Denver Water's forest health programs, which includes the From Forest to Faucets partnership with Denver Water, the U.S. Forest Service, the Colorado State Forest Service, and the Natural Resources Conservation Service, where we're taking an all hands, all lands approach to protecting watersheds and achieving landscape scale improvements to reduce the risk of uncharacteristic high intensity wildfires.
Thank you. Just as a reminder, this call is being recorded and a recording of this webinar will be available upon request. There will also be a Q&A after the speaking lineup has concluded, but throughout this webinar, if you have any questions at all, feel free to either drop it in the chat or drop it in the Q&A box. And so we will get started. I believe this question is for Kevin. How do fires impact the amount and timing of runoff reaching rivers and streams?
Yeah, sure. There's a lot to unpack there in terms of the overall water balance and hydrology. When it comes to wildfires, wildfires really impact all of the components of the entire water balance. So, and it makes a really a fairly unique disturbance relative to others. And so, if you think a fire coming through is going to change your forest canopy, and the loss of that forest canopy means any future events, we're going to have more water that's going to reach the forest floor, so an increase in net precipitation. But unlike other disturbances, fires also will consume that organic matter and change the structure of our soils, leave a layer of ash on those soils. And in many cases, especially with high severity fire, we also get a layer of hydrophobicity or water repellency. And so all of those things come together. You've got more water that's reaching the forest floor. Then when it reaches the forest floor, the structure of that soil has changed, and with water repellency, then we end up with more water that will flow over the surface of the soil rather than infiltrating. So in forests, our forests generally have very high infiltration capacity. So it's very rare that we see overland flow. Water is able to enter into that soil. But with the changes associated with wildfire, we see much more rapid movement of water off of those hill slopes and into streams. And just simply because of the loss of that interception from the canopy above, there's more water hitting the forest floor. So all of that comes together to lead to more water more often in our streams. And so the timing of peak flows, the timing of the rising limb of the hydrograph is often moved up in time. It's much more rapid delivery of water, and those peaks themselves tend to be much, much higher.
Thank you. And speaking of changing landscapes, this question is for you, Nina. Are mudslides and flash floods a risk everywhere after fires, or are there certain landscapes that are more susceptible?
Yeah, let's see. So there you will need steep terrain as a factor for having debris flows after a wildfire or flash floods. You will also need a burn of sufficient severity. So moderate to high severity burns are going to be more likely to produce flash floods or debris flows following a wildfire. And you know, another factor, and you also need high intensity rainfall to produce a debris flow or flash flood on a recent burn scar. And you'll notice I keep using the word debris flow. So debris flows are, there's a term mudslide that's been mentioned, but the term that we'd like to use in the science and are hoping we can get people to catch on to, because this is how it's put out in warnings, is debris flow. And so debris flows are a fast moving destructive mix of water, ash, soil, debris, and boulders. They're moving very quickly and can be very destructive to communities downstream of a burn area. So it also matters whether you have people living there. Are there people living on the at the base of these channels that come out of the steep terrain that burned, where you can have impacts? Or if you have not just populations, but also infrastructure there, water delivery infrastructure, these debris flows can increase the amount of sediment flowing into reservoirs and cause a problem as well.
Thank you for that. All right, so we do have a question, kind of still on this topic, so I want to get to it right now. From Luke, we have a question about drinking water quality. Are there concerns about public health with runoff from burn scars, or are utilities able to remove harmful compounds in wildfire runoff before it reaches the end user? Anyone can jump in for this.
So I can definitely start with some experiences we've had in California. We've seen instances where reservoirs receiving the runoff from a watershed that's been burned have a much higher incident of dissolved organic carbon, which in and of itself isn't a problem necessarily. It's something that has to be filtered out. However, in our disinfection processes, we, that having that high organic carbon can create products that we don't want to see, disinfection byproducts that are then kind of tricky to handle. So we do work with water systems to try to modify their treatment trains so that they're adjusting to understand that they're gonna have a high organic carbon load, usually for a couple of years after a fire. What that means is oftentimes switching to ozonization and other things in front of a treatment train to try to limit its impacts and address it. I would say it's a low concern. It's something we definitely work on. It's not, you know, an imminent health threat type of scenario, but we want to, you know, obviously provide the best quality water we can, and it is something we do address.
Would anyone else like to jump in on that question?
Sure, I can. So at least from Denver Water's experience with the fires, the Hayman Fire, which used to be Colorado's largest wildfire in 2002, and the Buffalo Creek Fire in 1996, we did see an increase in sediment and debris loading into the reservoir, which is more of an infrastructure protection type of concern, just because you have to dredge and remove the sediment and debris, and that's very costly. So from Denver Water's perspective, it was a smart business decision to try to invest in forest health to try to prevent these really catastrophic wildfires that cause these post-fire impacts, such as the sediment loading and debris. Sediment certainly causes issues with turbidity in the raw water source. And so some water utilities have flexibility within their system where they don't necessarily have to take the really high turbid water. So having flexibility in a water utility system is really important. What we've seen because of the large scale fires and how intense they were, that even several years later after these fires, we still saw elevated levels of total organic carbon, manganese, but all of those things can be removed through our treatment process. It's the lingering impacts to water quality, but also the infrastructure such as reservoirs that are so costly to water utilities.
Could I just add one additional thing to that from our perspective? That we've had a lot of discussions here in Oregon about the linkage between wildfires and nutrients. We understand that after wildfires, we can see anywhere from a 2 to 2,500 fold increase in nitrogen or phosphorus. Those are sort of the ranges that I've seen in the literature, and those can persist anywhere from 1 year to decades after some of the highest severity fires. And there is some uncertainty around the linkages between those nutrients and harmful algal blooms in some of our reservoirs. And we have had many discussions with harmful algal bloom experts in our area, where I think they don't quite truly understand the mechanisms and linkages between those nutrients and what's causing the blooms. But there is some anecdotal evidence that there may be some of those links. And I think things that we need to address going forward, because I know that those that rely on reservoirs, that can also create some real challenges.
Thanks, Kevin. Another question for Christina. With having more than a 1 million-acre watershed, where do you focus the work?
That's a really good question. We have researchers on board through the Colorado Forest Restoration Institute out of Colorado State University that have done a prioritization and a return on investment study specific for Denver Water's watersheds, because you're exactly right. We can't treat the whole 2.5 million acre watershed. And so it's really important to prioritize where these treatments are located. How the factors that go into that prioritization is proximity to critical infrastructure, such as reservoirs, diversions. What we've seen from past fires is debris can flow down approximately 11 miles to critical infrastructure. So that helps provide at least a radius to focus those treatments around critical infrastructure, but also taking into account where the highest risk acres are, where the wildfire risk is really high, and also the forest type. So all of those go into prioritizing where these treatments should be focused for the biggest bang for the buck.
Thank you for that. This question is for Nina. What were the weather conditions that contributed to this year's historic wildfire season?
Get unmuted there. Yeah, so I'll talk about the climate conditions leading up. So in a warming climate, we're already seeing and continuing to see higher temperatures and more extreme heat waves. drier conditions and more severe droughts. And these conditions dry, like we saw this year is a good example. These conditions dry out the vegetation and create hazardous conditions for wildfires. Also prolonged droughts like we had a few years ago in California will stress trees and other vegetation and make them susceptible to things like insect attacks like bark beetles. These can kill a large number of trees and create fuels for wildfire. There are also additional conditions associated with human activity like forest management, fire suppression, and increased population at this wildland urban interface where people living meets the forest's edge. And so all these factors serve to contribute to more hazardous wildfire conditions like we saw this year. We also had a rare lightning event at near the beginning of this year's wildfire season in California and the Pacific Northwest that caused issues as well. That really kicked off the season to create large wildfires.
Great, thank you. Another question. Anyone can jump in to answer this one. Can anyone give an example of how a city water supply has been adversely affected by this year's fires? An example of how a city water system is adapting for the future?
I can take that one. So Denver Water, we were really fortunate this wildfire season in Colorado. A lot of other partner water utilities north of Denver, they experienced truly Colorado's largest wildfire this year, two of them in their watersheds. And so they've been really impacted this year. Denver Water has had a small fire in its watershed. It's in a watershed that is less than 10% of our water supply. And so the impacts that we expect, it's in a high elevation forest. So we expect a lot of impacts to the reservoir and possibly our diversions when runoff occurs. So again, sediment debris concerns right now. And that was the Williams Fork fire that's in the watershed from this wildfire season. What Denver Water has done, and I think one reason why it's been promising for Denver Water this wildfire season, which isn't over yet, because of the proactive investments Denver Water's made in our critical watersheds, we have seen where these forest treatments have helped. We've had a wildfire start in one of our really critical watersheds early in the fire season. And because of the local fire responders responding quickly and a forest treatment being in place, the conditions were right that the fire was put out. It was suppressed in a really critical watershed. So we have seen success in investing in proactive management in our forests.
Great, thank you. Darren, how do fires affect water treatment costs?
Yeah, you know, every fire and every kind of impact from it can be unique, but the costs definitely accrue. There's several factors that kick in. So as I was talking before, they might have to modify their treatment process based on the runoff they're receiving to the reservoirs. And that can be expensive. You know, you try to go with the existing equipment you have, but modifying on the fly is always tricky and can be kind of extra expensive at times because you're going trying to go fast. The second level of dealing with it is we have now several years of communities suffering, you know, widespread damage within the community infrastructure themselves, housing losses and infrastructure losses within the distribution system. And so there's a lot of cost with just, you know, initially they face flushing and trying to clear out the potentially contaminated water, a lot of downtime associated with that, a lot of sampling they have to do. So there's costs associated with trying to determine where contamination is and how extensive it might be. So there's upfront costs immediately there. They often need extra personnel. Pulling a lot of samples and doing a lot of flushing is usually more than staffing that they have available. So they'll bring in through usually a Cal Warren here and other mutual aid assistance where water operators from other local facilities will come, but you know, they're still on the payroll and they need to be, their costs and expenses need to be covered. And then there's the recovery aspect in the distribution system, which often means replacing the infrastructure there. Sometimes lines have to be completely replaced, even though they're underground, they can be contaminated. A lot of meters and boxes and where, you know, there's access points are damaged and have to be placed. There's a lot of leaks to fix. So there's a lot of costs that accrue very fast in the initial recovery phase. A lot of those are FEMA type reimbursable coverages. So, you know, water systems, you know, can seek federal aid there and do get assistance. However, ultimately you can't have a disaster and expect everything to be covered. There's always long-term costs. And then finally, I guess I would say a lot of them, you know, now have to plan about how to be more fire resilient, and that may not have been in their capital investment planning. And so, you know, very likely they're going to need to do upgrades and hardening and other types of fixtures that will be needed to try to, you know, not have as big a disaster the next time around. And those are certainly continuing costs. So I think there's a definite downstream impact for quite some time and costs associated with the water systems.
Thank you. And this question's for anyone. We have another submission. Are there concerns with the watershed around the North Complex Fire and the Feather River? If there are concerns, what does that mean for the State Water Project and Californians who rely on it?
Yeah, I guess that's my backyard. So there's been quite a bit of monitoring done so far. We've you know, continuously monitored the watershed runoffs associated with the fire events. We haven't seen anything in particular different about the North Complex Fire. Luckily, it also goes to a very big reservoir and a very big watershed that obviously has diluting effects for anything that would be there. So as of the moment, we haven't noticed anything of concern associated with that. As been discussed here, there will be issues that Oroville Reservoir operations will have to understand of, you know, woody debris. It can come down and float on the reservoir and cause issues. There'll certainly be sedimentation that does occur from this impacts that'll be there. But from an immediate drinking water standpoint, we haven't noticed anything of concern.
Perfect, thank you. I'm going to give this one to Kevin. Just backtracking a little bit because we've gotten into the weeds a bit. What exactly is sediment and how does it impact fish, wildlife, and people?
What exactly is sediment? Well, how can I simplify this? Sediment are the component, small particulate matter associated with soils, really. There are definitions that are related to the size of the filter you might use when you filter water and what's left on that filter, and you know, it gets broken up into the different components. But really, it's sort of the sand, silt, clay components of soils, and many of those can persist, and the lighter particles can persist and remain in the water column and move downstream. The larger particles will settle out more readily, those sort of sand particles and accumulate. And so in terms of impacts, why we don't like sediment in our streams and downstream, those particles, one, just on their own, can, as they accumulate on the surface of the streams, you can get a loss of decrease of habitat opportunities for fish. They can smother fish eggs. There is evidence of decreases in predation success of fish, of clogging of fish gills if you've got too much sediment in the water system. Moving downstream, a lot of those particles have other elements adsorbed or stuck to their faces, you know, things like phosphorus or carbon, or many of the metals move along with them downstream. And certainly Christina and Darren can speak to the challenges that creates for drinking water treatment and reservoirs and blooms. Of course, telephone. So I'll mute now and let maybe one of them jump in.
Okay, thank you.
So from a treatment standpoint at a drinking water facility, you know, sediment is like always there. We're always planning to filter it out through a surface water treatment plant. But what happens is you have such increased loadings that it can really create problems for the facility. You know, we want to remove sediment. Obviously, a lot of it's, you know, as you mentioned, just fine particles of inert earth, but that interferes with later processes where we go through disinfection. We don't want to have a high turbidity when we're trying to disinfect the water. The bugs and the bacteria and the microbes that we're trying to kill during that process can hide in highly sediment water. So that's why we want to get it nice and clean before we apply those processes. So it becomes one of an overloading. Was the facility capable of handling that? A lot of places, you know, can have spare filters that they, you know, have kind of like off cycle for cleaning and other things. And this can force them to run the entire set of filters at full pace, which can then, you know, exhaust your ability at a treatment plant. You got to make sure that they have enough ability to handle the sludge that's generated from that. So it has a lot of impacts that can make it a very challenging event if it's not something that they're used to. If they were set up for a really clean water source and now it's really switched on them, that can be very problematic.
Yeah, and in terms of Denver Water's experience after those two large wildfires, it was very costly to deal with the sediment and debris that drained into Strontia Springs Reservoir, where 80% of Denver Water's water supply comes from. And so after those fires, we had about 1 million cubic yards of sediment drain into Strontia Springs. Denver Water spent approximately $28 million in recovery costs after those fires. Of that $28 million, $18.5 million was spent on a dredging operation to try to remove the sediment and debris that drained into Strontia Springs. So very costly project, but I think one important note is even 20 years later after these fires, we're still getting sediment and debris into Strontia Springs Reservoir, just again, because of how large scale and intense these fires are, the recovery has struggled. And so it's very costly to try to remove the sediment out. And all the sediment that we had spent that money on to remove and dredge away is now back in the reservoir. And so Denver Water has estimated that if through watershed management, forest health, these proactive investments, if we can just keep as little as 5% of sediment out of Strontia Springs Reservoir, Denver Water experiences a return on investment.
I'd like to just reiterate something that Christina mentioned there, and it backtracks on the earlier question about, well, have utilities seen an impact yet? And from our perspective here in Oregon, the Oregon Water Utilities Council estimated about 23 utilities were or are going to be impacted. And I think that it's the are going to be impacted because we're just at the front end of these systems starting to wet up and start to mobilize things. And so while utilities haven't really felt that effect yet, that there's a high likelihood that they will, and it will persist for long periods of time. We do have evidence from multiple fires of, you know, persistence of effects for multiple decades after, and you know, these effects once of sediment in the system, and they can propagate and move downstream and cause many issues years later. Just this past weekend, we had our largest rain event of the year. It was a fairly small event, but the city of Eugene, been working with them, and we've got water quality instruments out all over the watershed, and we picked up the highest levels of dissolved organic matter and highest levels of turbidity that they've measured in their systems in the last 10 years. And it was from a very small early year event. And so I think the effects are still to come and could persist for many years.
Thank you. Still kind of going back to the beginning, we do have a question from someone. I believe this one will be for you, Nina. What do we know about how burned forest affects snowpack and the timing of runoff? And does snow melt faster in a burned area versus an unburned area?
Yeah, I can start to address this one, but this might fall in Kevin's space. But following a fire, if you have the trees might be burned above the snow, and then you have snowfall. And when that dark ash either is blown from somewhere else or falls down onto the snowpack, you now have a darker surface on the snowpack that can absorb the sun's energy and change the melt time, how fast the snow melts, and change the melt time of the snow. It's definitely there's people working on this in detail. So I'll kick it over to Kevin to see if he has something to add on the timing and how it affects the hydrograph.
Yeah, I think you reflected it appropriately. Yeah, we often see increases in snowpack accumulation, so there's more water that's sitting there in that solid form. But yes, the energy reflectance off of those darkened trees, as well as the ash that does fall on the surface, will shift the timing of that melt, and we end up with more rapid melt, leading to higher peak flows. And again, that can contribute to the increases in erosion and sediment delivery and all the other problems we've been talking about.
Thank you. And also, what does post-fire mitigation work look like in burn scars that are hundreds of thousands of acres in size? And what techniques can utilities and managers use to lessen some of the impacts on the ground?
I can speak to that. So through the Forest of Fawcett's partnership, part of the recovery effort has been, we've planted over 1 million trees in the burn scars to try to help with recovery efforts. So that's one thing, is just trying to recover with vegetation planting, tree planting, and then also stream restorations. So helping to stabilize some of the streams and the channels where there is a lot of post-fire erosion. So we partnered with the Coalition for Upper South Platte, a local watershed group, and they secured some grant funds and Denver Water money and Aurora Water combined for a $1 million stream restoration that's helping to prevent sediment from moving downstream into the reservoir. Some other things that Denver Water did, we put in some sediment basins, some targeted sediment basins upstream of Cheeseman Reservoir, another reservoir of ours. Set a fire in the scale of the fire to try to prevent these large scale fires that are so costly to deal with.
Also, Christina, we do have a question from a phone participant. Do you think the fires in Northern Colorado this year represented a magnitude of change that will cause a rethinking of the current program, such as Denver's Forest to Fawcett's?
I think if anything, from this year's experience, it just shows the success and that we need to continue this successful partnership. I know I've had a lot of calls and inquiries from our Northern Colorado water utility partners. They're very interested in looking into the future, doing these proactive type investments, but right now they're so focused on the recovery efforts. And I think one unique thing about what we've seen this wildfire season is a lot of these large scale fires have occurred in high elevation lodgepole pine forests and in a lot of the beetle kill forests. So it will be a learning experience for all to see how these high elevation forests recover, especially when they were already impacted by the mountain pine beetle.
Thank you, Christina. We have roughly 20 minutes left on the call. So before we get into more questions, I would like to give the panelists some time to like really dive into their expertise, give us an overview really about what you do, who you are, and like maybe some of the goals for your organization to combat some of these challenges. Anybody feel free to jump in first before I call on people. Darren, you smile first though.
Guilty by smiling first. I like that. Sure. So So I'm with the regulatory side of this. Obviously, our main focus during a fire component is assuring that the water continues to be delivered, meeting all the health standards that we have in place. And that's been challenging in California. I think people have read that with the new ferocity of the fires, the fact that they've burned entire communities or large portions of communities, so that large portions are fire damaged where the homes are completely lost, and the discovery of having contaminants find their way into the distribution system, which was a kind of a new phenomena that we discovered in the Santa Rosa Tubbs fire several years ago, and is now repeated a couple times. I should mention it's not every fire that burns a community has that impact. There's some circumstances and some particular things that lead to it that we're not totally have a grasp of yet. So we can't naturally predict like this one's going to happen and this one's not. So we check them all and we find it here and there. But it does seem to involve the dewatering of some level of the water system and then the burning of the infrastructure. And we don't know whether it's pulling in unburnt gases from homes that are, you know, on fire while the water system's dewatering, whether it's the materials themselves burning. It's very likely both. So there's much work to be done yet on exactly where the contamination comes from, but we do know it exists. And we have now put in place protocols associated with the testing and then the flushing right away to try to remove that material. Those volatile organics that are there do both adsorb and absorb to the insides of the pipe materials. And so they're present. It's not just like you got to flush the water once, it's multiple flushings over time to try to get them out and move them forward. And then probably harder than the technical aspects of the whole thing is the public communication aspect. You know, we work with our water systems on communicating to their public through do not use, do not boil, you know, do not drink type of water public notices. So it's real important to inform the public. I think a lot of people oftentimes aren't quite clear of why we would, you know, allow water that has some contamination in it to still go to a home. And I think we often forget that water is used for sanitation in the home, it's used for cleaning, and it has a lot of other functions that are very protective of public health beyond its consumption. And obviously we do want to get it to a consumption level again, but we do want to make sure that people have the ability to do cleaning. You know, when you're in a fire zone and it may be a house that didn't burn, you know, you need to clean the dust from the interior. The ash can be toxic with metals. You need to have sanitation in your home for it to be habitable, you know, and protect people there. So it's a very tricky balance. It's a hard thing that we're still trying to perfect about how to best communicate with the public. But that's a big role we play as well in trying to make sure we go forward there. And that's been our main role. You know, we do some planning with the agencies around their protection of their infrastructure. We'll obviously be looking at, you know, how to be more protective in the future from the lessons we learned and protect their watersheds and their sources from a standpoint. So I'll pause there. I'm sure that causes enough questions. We need other people to go. So who's going to smile next?
Actually, that was very helpful. If I'm going by who laughed first, I'm going with Nina.
All right. So I'll keep on the line of post wildfire debris flows and flash floods, since that's my interest in, you know, where we want to go with this in the science. And so I mentioned that, you know, following a wildfire, soils become water repellent. So when intense rainfall occurs, it runs off instead of being absorbed into the soil, and can cause flash floods or these fast moving destructive mix of material as debris flows and cause impacts. And it's important to note, it doesn't take a lot of rain to cause the flash floods and debris flows on burn areas. It just needs to be high intensity rain for about 15 to 30 minutes. And it also, these post-fire flash floods and debris flows do not only happen in wet years with lots of rainfall in the season. They can and often do occur with the first intense rain of the season, and can occur in a drought year even. So it's really important to understand that we can have these catastrophic events even in dry years or without a lot of storm total rainfall. And so a great example of this is the 9th of January, 2018, debris flow in Montecito. This was a very weak atmospheric river. The storm total over a day or two was not a lot of rain, but it had this very short window of extremely intense rainfall. It was also the first significant storm of the season, and the area was in moderate drought going into the storm and also after the storm. And in a warming climate with all the impacts I talked about earlier and more area burned, especially if it's close to where people live, we start to have more areas that can potentially experience these post-fire impacts. We also anticipate rainfall to intensify in a warming climate, which increases the concern for these post-fire hazards. And some of the things that we're trying to work on is improve forecasting of rainfall, of this short duration, high intensity rainfall, trying to figure out where and when it will occur and improve our understanding of the drivers and how to model it in weather forecast models. Where also my colleagues in geology and geomorphology are working on improving prediction of debris flow characteristics. So improving our understanding of what are the thresholds to trigger debris flows, how far will they run out, what's the distance they'll travel out of the steep terrain, how much area will they inundate, so what will be the depth of that material that comes out, and trying to understand how we might target mitigation efforts. And this becomes increasingly important to understand these things as we see the fire seasons lengthening with drier spring and fall expected in a warming climate. So now we have the fire season right back it up onto the wet season. And in some places, like in Colorado, for example, you do have summertime thunderstorms. So you may have a very short window to put in to do your mitigation, your post-fire mitigation after the fire. And in some cases, the debris, like with the Montecito case, the fire is still burning, isn't totally out, before the debris flow risk is present. So being able to respond quickly is extremely important.
Thanks, Nina. We'll go to Kevin next.
Sure. This for me, I guess sort of thinking about the things that I'm interested in and that might be relevant to this group. My research and research program as it relates to fire, I always describe as a mile wide and a millimeter thin. I kind of bounce around and really interested in all of it and all of the pieces. And so while I initially started working in forests, in headwater systems, and understanding how fires can change timing availability and peak flows and low flows and annual water yields, as well as physical water quality, sediment, stream temperature, all of the major nutrients, nitrogen, phosphorus, and carbon and heavy metals. I also got interested and have started moving downstream and sort of linking those at larger basin scales and certainly implications for community water supply. And I really appreciate the interest from this group in putting this together. I think from my experience, every big fire year, it always comes as a surprise to many about this issue and the costs associated with this issue and related issues. You know, we always hear about the costs associated with fire suppression. You know, a year like this, with probably going to cost in the neighborhood of $3 billion, and we will have exceeded $3 billion in fire suppression in three of the last 4 years, and that cost continues to grow as we can continue to see more high severity fires and large wildfires on our landscape. But to me, it's, you know, sort of we're at this time of year where so many, we don't have the smoke anymore keeping us in our homes in many of these communities, and many think, okay, all of the problems are over. But for us who deal with sort of aquatic ecosystem health or community drinking water supply, it can often be when all of our problems are starting to prop up so I appreciate the opportunity to have this discussion and sort of educate folks on some of these downstream and longer term costs. I've seen estimates from natural resource economists that the costs associated with loss of recreational value and tourism and the implications for upgrades to water utilities or the additional cost to utilities can be on the neighborhood of anywhere from 2 to 23 times greater than the suppression costs alone. And so, you know, sort of thinking about that, it's far more difficult, I think, for us to wrap our minds around and to put numbers to those things. Very easy to figure out those suppression costs. But thinking about that, I think these are really important problems, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this. The other thing that we're really interested in that's linked to this and is something we don't have a lot of good information about as of yet is how we respond to these fires. And Christina talked a lot about some really good things that Denver Water is doing in terms of getting some reestablishment of vegetation on the landscape and stabilizing hill slopes. But what we see a lot here are our landowners and land managers running out, and we have a very small window of time with which to recoup some of that lost natural resource value by salvage logging. And so there's a very widespread salvage logging happening. And in some cases, we've seen that actually benefit systems and move them along more rapidly to recovery. In other cases, we've seen it exacerbate the problem and make things worse. And we're at a point where we don't really have good broad information or knowledge about salvage logging and then the associated tools, you know, mulching, application of seeds, those sorts of things to help stabilize hill slopes at a broad scale, especially here in Oregon. Now this year, the West Side Fire is a really unique location that we haven't had in our recorded history, fires of this magnitude. It'd be really interesting to see sort of just the implications of the fire, plus then our response to that and what that might mean for longer-term water quality or quantity issues.
Thanks, Kevin. Christina?
So I know we talked a lot about the problems with large-scale wildfires, but I can share more about solutions, such as the Forest of Faucets Partnership. Again, that's with Denver Water, the U.S. Forest Service, the Colorado State Forest Service, and the Natural Resources Conservation Service. So the goal of this partnership is to make proactive investments in forest and watershed health for reducing the risk of catastrophic wildfires and protect our source water. The Forest of Faucets Partnership it's been a smart business decision for Denver Water, and we have experienced a return on investment since the partnership began in 2010. Denver Water only owns 2% of the 2.5 million acre watershed, and about 54% of those 2.5 million acres are national forests. So partnerships are the only way Denver Water can have a meaningful and strategic impact on the landscape. And partnerships are also important from a utility perspective for understanding the science behind decision-making, the value to our customers, and return on investment in achieving healthier forests and watersheds. For example, in 2018, in Summit County, there was a wildfire that occurred, and a fuel break put in through Forest of Faucets Partnership saved approximately $1 billion with a B of homes and infrastructure. And then also the forest treatments that were put in around Cheeseman Reservoir right before the Hayman Fire occurred in 2002, they saved our facilities around the reservoir. So Denver Water has seen a return on investment. And after experiencing the clear benefits of being proactive through forest management, Denver Water is committed to the health of our forests to reduce the risk of catastrophic wildfire. So it's crucial to have healthy forests for healthy watersheds.
Thank you so much for that. All right, so it is 1:53 Eastern, 10:53 Pacific. We do have another question. This question is from Kara. I apologize if I mispronounce that. How do we begin to communicate to residents the importance of prescribed burns and dealing with smoke on a regular basis versus the impacts of intense smoke during large catastrophic fires? And what are the most important talking points for this effort? Anybody can jump in on this one.
I'll jump in quickly. And I think that And certainly climate is the big knob that we have to be concerned about in terms of our future fires. And we have to deal with climate. But there are things that we can do in certain locations to lessen the severity of fire in key locations where it may burn into our communities. And I think the tools we have are sort of mechanical or prescribed fire. And I know there's a lot of resistance from folks around prescribed fire because of the smoke issue. But you know, think about these issues, prescribed fire is really very benign relative to large catastrophic wildfire in terms of the implications for quantity and quality of water and the long-term implications. And a prescribed fire that is low severity, yes, it's going to put some smoke in the air, which is unhealthy. And it's hard to compare the smoke issues. But certainly there is no comparison when it comes to the water piece with prescribed versus high severity. And I would take prescribed fire impacts any day.
Would anyone else like to jump in on that question?
I can just say, I think that's a difficult one, and it's one where collaborating with social scientists may be really helpful and helping us take the science and get the messaging right. Where I live here in Santa Rosa in Sonoma County, there does seem to be a shift in, I've only lived here for about 6 months, but with folks here who have been evacuated now numerous times over the last 4 years, there is a shift now. They're saying, please, can we have controlled burns so that we're not worried about these catastrophic fires that are coming for our houses. And I think there's still a challenge we had. I used to live in Reno, Nevada, and we had a prescribed fire that got out of control and did burn down a few homes. And so there's still a lot of fear around that. And so I think it's just a conversation that needs to keep happening, but that after this year, we may be seeing a shift in people's tolerance of the prescribed fires, just because that's got to be a better outcome than worrying about your home and multiple weeks of smoke.
Thanks, Nina. Seeing no more questions at this time, I would like to thank our panelists and our attendees. If you have any more questions, please feel free to email Nicole. A recording of this briefing will also be available upon request. I hope everyone has a fantastic day.